We in the West have been spending only about 10% of our disposable income on food. 10%. Back in the 1950s, that same food cost us 20%. What made food so cheap during the past 6.5 decades was an agriculture based on cheap oil. Well, that oil isn't cheap anymore, and we look to alternatives like corn ethanol to fuel our economy. As a consequence, of course, the price of corn has doubled. Well, guess what? That corn is a staple of our food chain, and now the price of all those foods that are made from corn, everything from milk to cookies, is going through the roof. This leads one to ask, can we grow food and fuel and still live so cheaply?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 547th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Aberdeen who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the board. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producers Carol Stafford and Parmley Taff are on the road, but producer Kelsey Olson is here. Hello, Kelsey.
Good morning, Dad.
Folks, with food so cheap, we've been living high on the hog. But this cheap food was made possible by an agriculture fueled with cheap oil. Oil isn't cheap anymore. As a point in fact, our good neighbor to the south, Hugo Chavez, has just kicked our oil companies out of his oil patch and has flown off to Iran to form a mutual admiration society. And so we look to alternatives to oil, like corn ethanol, to keep ourselves living high on the hog. But corn is a foundation for many of the foods we eat, everything from milk to cookies. And this summer, some say milk prices may go as high as $5 a gallon. And so today we pause to ask, can we grow our food and our fuel and still live high on the hog? Here to help us today look at this question, we have David Bloom, who is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. David, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're up there in Berkeley.
Yes, that's where I am today.
And congratulations on Alcohol Can Be a Gas. It's on the press. It's been you've been working on it for a while, and it's here it is.
Yes, it's been quite an effort over the last 4 years to try to get the accurate information to dispel the kind of myths we're going to be talking about today.
Huh. I think I figured out what happened there. It must be my other caller, so I'll try that again. Let's see. Oops. Larry, is that you?
Yes, sir.
Something's happening. It sounds like we've got some interference.
Maybe I think we're okay now.
Okay, good. back to you quickly, David. You have been kind of like the Johnny Appleseed of ethanol for quite a while, have you not? They're going around spreading the message to people?
Yeah, I've been working in the ethanol field for over 25 years, and it's, you know, quite a difficult task to get the accurate information out there when we're, you know, faced daily with press releases from the American Petroleum Institute.
Okay, so, and I suspect that, however, people are starting to listen to you, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's been quite a transition in the last 18 months or so. Up until then, you couldn't find a good article, a positive word anywhere about ethanol, and for a while now, we've been getting some decent press. So, of course, the counterattack is on now, and there's quite a concerted effort to try to discredit ethanol in the media.
Okay, now why? Who's doing this? Why do people want to discredit ethanol?
Well, you know, there's an old saying: the farther back you look, the farther forward you can see. And if you look at the history of ethanol, you'll find that the oil companies have done a lot to manage our perceptions about what's going on in the ethanol market and in the whole production of ethanol. In fact, most people wouldn't know from reading their history books that Rockefeller enlisted the aid of the Women's Christian Temperance Movement to basically put alcohol out of business as a fuel in the United States.
Carry Nation with her axe, right?
Carry Nation with her axe and $4 million to go ahead and buy Congress to pass a constitutional amendment called Prohibition to take alcohol off the market. So, you know, when you look
and this
back,
this was sponsored by Rockefeller?
Oh, absolutely. And he was actually working on this very same campaign around the world, but the United States was the only place he succeeded. Because up until the early 1900s, alcohol and gasoline were neck and neck in terms of which fuel would be the dominant fuel of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much Rockefeller had the cities locked up with cheap gasoline, because you got to realize gasoline is the toxic waste byproduct of the, at that time, the heating and lighting industry. And so at night, Rockefeller would have to flush the volatiles that nobody wanted, you know, because made oil lamps explode, et cetera, into rivers. And so, you know, he could sell that really cheap in the cities. But when you went out to the country, you stopped at a farm and you tanked up on alcohol, which very commonly was made on most farms in the United States.
And Henry Ford, he was betting on alcohol being the propellant, was he not?
Well, absolutely. He was dead set against Rockefeller's view of where fuel should come from. The Model A and T were both our first flex fuel vehicles, in other words, able to run on both alcohol or gasoline. In the Model A, you just turned a knob to the right of the dash to adjust the air-fuel mixture so that you could go from one fuel to the other. And the Model A sported a digital distributor. In other words, you use the five digits of your left hand to adjust the spark advance so that you'd be able to switch from alcohol to gasoline.
And so really, there is a history, a great history then, of alcohol as fuel.
Oh, all around the world. You know, until the end of World War II, there weren't tankers, you know, to deliver oil or gasoline. So many countries in the world, New Zealand, the Philippines, Brazil, all ran on alcohol, and in particular Germany ran on alcohol right up until the end of World War II. In fact, in the Nuremberg Accords, we have a provision that says that Germany cannot rebuild its alcohol plants because that's what allowed them to stay in the war so long. You know, if you would have bombed
alcohol then.
Yeah, because there were thousands of distilleries supplying the fuel for German war machine. If you only had to bomb two or three, you know, refineries, the war would have been over. And, you know, we couldn't get rid of Hitler's fuel supply for years because of this.
Because they were independent of petroleum.
Because they had a national system of farmers being able to produce fuel from their potatoes.
Wow. So can alcohol be a gas in today's economy, do you think, David?
Well, I think it's basically inevitable at this point. What we have to face is that we're already entering the period of peak oil, where we're not going to be able to produce enough oil for the demands of the world. And it doesn't matter how many places we drill, it doesn't matter how many wars we go to, you know, we're not going to create more oil because that was done at one time in history and it is not continuing. In other words, we're draining that fixed supply. So really at this point, we have to look at something based on solar energy for our liquid fuel supply, and alcohol is pretty much the hands-down cost-effective winner in that regard.
Okay, and that takes us, of course, to our second guest today, who is Larry Mitchell, American Corn Growers Association. Larry, this must be great news for the farmers of the United States.
Well, it comes with some mixed reviews, but it is a bit better than it has been. American corn farmers have been selling their products for well under their own cost of production for over a decade, and we have seen an improvement in the prices over the last 8 to 10 months.
I've heard that said so many times, but how do you do something below your cost of production and sell it for below your cost of production for decades? How does that work?
It's very difficult. We've seen a huge influx of people moving out of rural America. We've had an unsettling of rural America. Farmers have been forced to consume their equity to remain on the farm. And we've also supplemented it with tens of billions of dollars of subsidies from taxpayers. And Congress found it much easier, or the path of least resistance, to throw subsidies to farmers, which in turn was then passed directly on to the consumer, mm-hmm. as opposed to providing a system to allow farmers to get a fair price for what they raise.
I always think things should cost what they cost. And it makes it a lot easier to understand that way, I think. Since over the past, 4 or 5 years, the price of corn has really doubled, has it not?
In the past 10 months, it's
10
doubled
months.
Because as short a period ago as the fall of 2005, I had members in the American Corn Growers Association delivering corn for as little as $1.18 a bushel and using $3.30 diesel to deliver it when it cost them about $3 to raise it.
Wow.
Well, you know,
those are tough numbers.
Yes, they're very tough numbers. And now we've seen corn approach $4, and it's gone over $4 for a few short periods since last Labor Day. But right now, it's back down well below $3.50. So we're settling in at what the old cost production was. But the cost production is due to energy prices is going up quite rapidly.
Right.
I just talked to one of my guys in Southern Illinois yesterday, and anhydrous ammonia, which we use for a nitrogen fertilizer,
is going
has about quadrupled in price.
Okay, you're going to have to hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, Larry Mitchell from the American Corn Growers Association. Can we grow our food and our fuel at the same time and still live high on the hog? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Hey, welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about the price of fuel and the price of food and the increasing interdependence of both of those prices. We see that the price of fuel is going up. We see that the price of food is going up. Everything is heading in one direction. And we're looking at the alternatives and seeing if we can find a way to live high on the hog like we have for the 6.5 decades. I think that's you, Larry. What
my
are you
apologies.
Doing? And we're seeing if we can figure out a way of living high on the hog like we have for the 6.5 decades when we relied on an agriculture based almost entirely on cheap oil, which of course is no longer there. So we're going to go to we're going to have an interesting call here from we're going to check in on Deanna from Dayton, Oregon. Deanna, welcome to The Food Chain. Are you there? Let's see. Maybe I don't. There, I got her. Deanna?
Yes.
Welcome to The Food Chain. You're a hog farmer?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good.
Well, I've been watching what's been going on with the corn, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's becoming very expensive to feed our pigs. And what I've noticed, well, my husband and I started studying about ethanol a while back.
Right.
And we found out that corn can be used several times, up to 4 times. So we feel that the ethanol companies are being very wasteful, and as a result, it's driving up the price of corn.
So what do you mean? What do you mean by corn can be used 4 times?
The corn can be reused. Like, let's say that the ethanol companies run it through 1 time. They can take that corn again and run it through again.
Maybe I can shed some light on this.
David Bloom, please do.
So, basically, when you take corn, and I'm going to give, this is going to be a little bit of a long answer because it really applies directly to your farm and how we do agriculture.
Right.
When we talk about why we feed grain to our livestock, the primary reason we feed it to them, especially in the case of cattle, less so in the case of hogs, is that we need to give them the protein and fat that are in the grain. The starch that's in the grain, which is 75% of the grain, in many cases is poorly digested by animals, especially cattle, you know, less so with hogs again. So when we make alcohol, we only take the starch out of the corn. In other words, that's the carbohydrate part, which came from carbon dioxide from the air and water and sunlight. So that's what we make into alcohol. The byproduct that's left over still looks like grain. It takes up about a third of the volume. And that's called dried distillers, grains, and solubles. It's what's left over. But it has everything that's not the carbohydrates. So it has everything that came from the soil, meaning the protein and fat, which... You
all
know,
the good
reason.
All the good stuff, none of the bad.
All the good stuff. So when you feed that to animals instead of the original corn, a very interesting thing happens. You get more meat than you would have gotten if you would have fed the original corn. It's better animal feed. In the case of cattle, you're looking at about a 17% greater weight gain than if you would have fed the original corn because cattle very poorly digest starch. Now, in the case of pigs, raising for meat, you can go ahead and use up to 50% dried distillers grains based on the University of Minnesota studies. And so what we're doing is getting...
Yeah, but we have been told that we should not feed it more than 10%.
Yeah, that's very old information. If you go to the University of Minnesota website, you'll see very detailed studies on every kind of livestock with extensive feeding trials, and you can see what applies to your situation. But I did that research for my book, and up to 50% for fattening up hogs is okay. More than that, you get too much fiber, and you can run into some problems.
We also have to feed our gestating sows and lactating sows.
And they only can go up to about 30%.
Yeah, they need the carbohydrates.
They can use, unlike cattle, they can use some of the carbohydrates in corn. But most of the corn in the United States is fed right now to cattle for both dairy and for meat. So, this would only be an issue if every bit of corn was turned into alcohol, of course. Now, the reason...
Well, we still are stuck with 50% of our corn, and that we have to use. Like, let's say we did use 50% of the corn for DDGS. If we have to buy the other 50% at a really high price, we still kind of have a problem here.
Well, now you're going to get better weight gain with the dry distiller's grain, so that's going to take back some of the increase. But I got a challenge. For instance, the reason why the increase is going on in grain right now, you can't lay that at the footsteps of ethanol. If you take a look at what's going on in the, this is the basic premise of our conversation, and I'm saying that that's not correct, that that's basically propaganda. If the price...
Propaganda from whom?
Well, from the American Petroleum Institute.
Okay, fair enough. Continue.
If I can jump in...
Please do, Larry Mitchell.
Also from the food processing industry that's just doing some horrible price gouging right now on American consumers.
Absolutely.
The price of corn has gone up, but there's so little corn in the products that we usually eat. A 20-ounce soft drink only had a half a cent worth of corn in it to start with. Now it's got a 1 cent, all the sweetener in that 20-ounce soda. Only cost a penny now at $4 corn, yet they're wanting to go up 20 and 30 cents a bottle.
Yeah, so that's...
But we still haven't addressed my point that the corn can be used by the ethanol companies more than once, and it
right.
would make sense if they could run it through four times that it would be more efficient.
You can't make any more alcohol from it by running it through again, except... a process which is not yet commercially viable, which I'm sure we'll talk about as we get into the show, called cellulose processing, because part of the...
Well, no, I disagree with that. I've done all the studies. My husband went to the classes, and I wish he was here now, and he could tell you all about it. But as far as I know, the corn can be run through as much as four times, and old revenuers used to do that.
Well,
that's what they call
salad
different. Mash. They would just add some more sugar to it.
Deanna, thank you for the call. Really appreciate that.
Now, let me kind of go back to the issue of, are we really looking at ethanol being the cause of this price increase? If that was true, you would look at the price of alcohol on the Chicago Board of Trade, and it would be going up as well. If the price of the raw material went up double, you'd expect that to have an effect on the price of alcohol. And it has not had any effect at all. It's basically the corn futures are running flat for the next year or so. So what's causing the price to go up is basically what most people don't understand is that the corn price is set by people who gamble on the price of corn when it comes to deliver it. So earlier this year, the oil company started buying corn contracts at, nearly double what the usual price is. And others wanting to get in on the greed and speculation have followed in, but they're going to get hurt pretty bad because, as our other guest has pointed out, the oil companies give with one hand with these contracts and take back with the other by providing the fertilizer at four times the price it used to be. Now, why would they do this? Over the last 18 months, hundreds of billions of dollars have poured into building new alcohol plants. And that had to be stopped, just stopped dead. The oil companies are not going to put up with that. So by doubling the price of corn, they've essentially dried up the venture capital going into the ethanol sector.
Oh. So their principal goal as you state here, you believe that what they really want to do is to stop the development of ethanol plants.
Absolutely. This
harkens back to what you said about Rockefeller.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's why I brought it up, because, you know, what's happening then is happening now. We can even look as far back as last year and see that the oil companies gamed the price of alcohol last year. Price of alcohol went up to double its historical price last year for a few months, and everyone said in the press, oh, you see, alcohol is not practical, it's too expensive. And the crowning piece of that propaganda campaign was a Consumers Report article which only looked at the last year's supply of alcohol and concluded that ethanol was a bad deal for America. The following week, the oil companies crashed the futures market on alcohol, dropping it from over $3 to $1.70 in 1 week. Because the reality is, 99% of the alcohol produced in the United States is sold to the oil companies to blend with gasoline.
Folks, got to take a quick break, right back. Do stay tuned. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, what do you think, folks? Do you think it's possible that the oil companies don't want us to develop alternatives to oil? That seems to be the suggestion David Bloom, the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, is making. David, want to follow up on that?
Well, I just got to say that this is not some grand conspiracy theory. This is just business as usual for the oil companies. When you've got hundreds of billions in profit every year, it costs very little to go ahead and game the corn market by offering to pay more for corn and then taking that money back by increasing the price of fertilizer. This is not a new strategy. They've done things like this every time alcohol has become a serious threat. And it is a serious threat because alcohol can be produced at about $30 to $40 a barrel.
You know, ooh, wait a minute. And gasoline or petroleum's now, what, $70 a barrel?
Yeah, and going up, because as it runs out, it's just going to continue to go up in price. So, you know,
and that's the price of petroleum, not the price of gasoline per barrel.
That's correct. And as, you know, our guest has been pointing out, the price of energy when it comes to producing food is more than accounts for the increase in the price of food separate from the price gouging that we're seeing. So we're not, you know, it's nothing to do really with the demand for alcohol, because the demand for corn this year compared to last year for alcohol is hardly any different. But this year, now think about this for a minute. You're a trader in futures for corn contracts, and the Wall Street Journal puts out a story that says corn farmers increase production of corn by 20 million acres. Well, if you're a good futures trader, you flip open a book and you realize that we only plant 70 million acres normally. This is an enormous increase in the amount of corn being produced. So if you're a futures trader, the first thing you're going to think is sell, get out of corn futures, because come this fall, there's not going to be enough silos in the United States to put all that corn. You know, the farmers have bought the same publicity that the public has about ethanol creating a demand for corn, and are overproducing, as farmers always do. And I can say that because I'm a farmer. I know what my brethren do. So, you know, they saw what they thought was a shortage. They went ahead and overproduced. Come this fall, they're going to be hurting to sell that corn.
Larry Mitchell, American Corn Growers Association, what do you say to that?
I think he's exactly right. I think that most of this run-up in corn prices is speculative. There's some operative aspects of it. There has been an increase in the use of corn for ethanol, but then again, for every 3 pounds of corn we use for ethanol, we still have a pound left for a higher quality livestock feed. But interestingly enough, the investment community that's put a lot of the money out in Mid-America to make ethanol have also come to realize that in 1996, in the Freedom to Farm Act, we abandoned any sort of stock program. We don't have any corn set back for bad times. When we went to war 4 years ago, we only had 5 hours worth of corn in government hands.
5 hours?
5 hours. 5 hours worth of corn, 8 hours worth of soybeans, and about 11 and a half days worth of wheat.
So we have nothing in the cupboard.
There's nothing in the cupboard. There's absolutely nothing in the cupboard. So that adds to the speculation. But then when we get to the operative side, our overseas customers for corn have looked at all of this and said, hey, wait a minute. We've been very used to a very inexpensive product with just-in-time delivery, and now that may be threatened. And so at $3.50 and $4 corn, we've seen a fairly significant increase in our exports this year.
Even when corn is very, very high, people are buying it.
Well, it certainly busts the myth of the last 40 years that we have to have cheap corn in order to export more, and that that is the course that we must take to become profitable.
Let me ask.
We know that that doesn't work.
Let me ask exactly.
Both of you, this question, it seems to be that we're sending a lot of our money to India and China for manufactured goods, and they now have a lot of money with which to buy things. And they're buying a lot of our food. One thinks of cheese, for one example. What impact is that having on the price of food as well?
I mean, not a thing, Michael, because one of the problems we have now in the United States is that we've permitted, with virtually no oversight, the use of genetically modified corn. And only four countries in the world will buy our corn at this point, officially, although a few do it under the table. So we really destroyed our export market for corn by going into genetically modified seed.
Larry, is that true?
It's absolutely true. In fact, if you will look at three U.S. foreign policy decisions in the 1990s, one was NAFTA, which opened up the Mexican border to U.S. corn for the first time. The second was Freedom to Farm, which dropped the price of corn by over 40%, and it never has recovered until this last fall. And the fact that we decided as a government not to segregate and label our genetically engineered corn, therefore losing most of our good customers overseas. We dump a lot of very cheap corn on Mexico. This has resulted in somewhere between 2 and 10 million Mexican farmers being pushed off the land. And I think you might understand the ramifications of that given the Senate debate over the last 2 days.
Wow.
So when it comes to, you know, making alcohol, one of the things we really need to do that I push in my book is, one, we have to start monitoring oil company purchases of the raw material for alcohol, because they can distort what would otherwise be a free market.
Which is what they've been doing with corn, right?
Yes. But, you know, anyone will tell you that a corn farmer is not a corn farmer. A corn farmer is a corn and soybean farmer. In other words, there's a crop rotation between the two major crops
One is the legume. The soybean is the legume, right?
Right, which helps provide nitrogen and breaks the pest cycle and, you know, does good things by alternating with corn. But we have a lot of other crops that we talk about in my book that we can grow for alcohol that we ought to be working into this rotation and make ourselves less vulnerable to this kind of price manipulation.
Now, are we talking about the difference between grain ethanol and cellulosic ethanol?
We could be talking about that, but I'm saying, you know, that in the press you seem to see that those are the only two options. But in between those options, there are many other things. For instance, all the way up as far as Michigan, we can grow sugar beets as a rotation, which give us 1,000 gallons an acre compared to corn's 250 plus per acre. We can grow sorghum, you know, the same kind that is used for making sorghum molasses as far north as Ohio even. And sorghum is kind of like temperate sugar cane. You cut down the stalk and you squeeze the juice out. We can get 800 plus gallons from sorghum. We can be looking at crops we wouldn't normally think of, like Jerusalem artichokes and all the way up as far as the Arctic Circle almost, and those give us 600 to 800 gallons per acre. And all of these provide good quality animal feed byproducts, so we're not talking about destroying, you know, our animal feed supply by going to other products.
Okay, caller wants to know if the extra water we use to nurture the corn is a bad trade for the ethanol. Don't we need that water?
Well, I'll make a quick comment, but I'm sure our guest will have something to say about this, too. Basically, most of the corn in the United States is unirrigated. Farmers are totally dependent on rain to make that corn happen.
So there you go. Is that true, Larry?
Yeah, that's exactly true. And I've got to agree with our other guest completely. And may add this. You know, if we looked at the typical U.S. farm 100 years ago, that farm used half of its production for the horsepower it took to run that farm.
Right.
Between the horses, the mules, and the people that were on that farm. A significant portion of the other half of what was raised went for the other parts of the community that needed energy. Whether it was the preacher's buggy or the doctor's mount or the ice wagon or the livery stable, you understand that 100 years ago, most of our energy was renewable, farm-based, and local.
Right.
And with the advent of the oil age, which is you know, in the history of mankind, just a blip on the screen, 100 years old. It's over half over, and we better be looking at Plan B in a big hurry.
Folks, this is Food Chain. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Can we grow food and fuel and live high on the hog at the same time? Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hi, folks! How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed portable elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Well, folks, you know, I've been following the story of ethanol ever since the 9/11 incident when our Twin Towers were bombed in New York City. I had at the time in my hands a paper on cellulosic ethanol put together by a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, James Woolsey. And he said, look, folks, we got to do something because something is going to happen if we don't. And there in front of my eyes on the television that day, something was happening. So once in a while, every few months, I've picked up this issue and put it on the food chain, and we've been following it along. And when we first started, you know, I asked some of the top scientists in the land if it was possible to take the money that we're sending to the Middle East for oil and instead give it to our farmers to grow our fuel. Every one of them so far has said yes. And so I'm asking again today. Let's start with Dave Bloom, who is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Is it going to be possible, Dave, for us to take all the money that we're sending to the Middle East and instead give it to our farmers?
Well, it's not only a better idea, it'd be a lot cheaper. I mean, nobody has, I don't think, any illusions that the only reason we're in Iraq is because they have oil. I mean, you know, if it was a country without oil, we wouldn't be there.
Well, given the fact that our economy and our livelihoods and our food all depend 100% on oil, maybe it's not a bad place to be.
Well, let's talk about the way I would like to see us do it, the way I lay it out in the book. There's some very convenient numbers we can use. It takes about $1 per annual gallon of capacity to build an alcohol plant. So that means, if you want to build a plant that makes 50 million gallons, you need to spend $50 million. Now, we currently, we can make that alcohol, except for this temporary blip we have in the price of corn, for about $1 a gallon. So we take
now
a look
at... Now we can make alcohol for $1 a gallon?
We have been up until the last few months where corn has gone up, and so the price has gone up a little bit. But the ability for us to produce alcohol for ourselves, you ought to look at how much fuel we use as a nation. So we use 140 billion gallons of gasoline a year. So that's a big number. But we just set a cost of $1 per gallon to build the alcohol plant. So That would mean we'd need $140 billion to build enough alcohol plants to run the entire country without any oil being used whatsoever. Now, we have spent $500 billion in Iraq in the last few years. So we could have already built enough plants to power the entire country and actually have built enough plants around the world to fuel every nation on the planet with alcohol permanently and totally doing without oil from now on with the money we've spent in Iraq. So, you know, has it been good business management to spend money to try to secure oil in Iraq when we could have given it to infrastructure for our farmers to produce a whole variety of crops that we could be totally energy self-sufficient now and end global warming? Because alcohol, as I mentioned earlier, is made from carbon dioxide from the air, water, and solar energy. That's all that's in alcohol. When we burn alcohol in our car, the solar energy is what drives our car down the road as that alcohol explodes, and we return that same carbon dioxide and water back for next year's crop. So we're not adding or subtracting any CO2 from the atmosphere, and if we don't add any more, Earth's systems can easily absorb the excess carbon dioxide that's there now. So I can't think of a more cost-effective way to solve so many problems at one time as it would be to, you know, put money into America's farmers and the world's farmers to be able to produce fuel. Because, you know, if you have all the energy you need and all these byproducts for animal feed and for human food, what's left to fight over?
Ah, well, there must be something. Pretty girls, maybe. Larry Mitchell, are farmers up to something like this?
Well, absolutely. I mean, let's put it in the context of this week. We're coming up on Independence Day, and you know, we've got a president that's decided we needed to go to war for democracy or whatever other reason we're in Iraq. And if you, you know, he continually tries to paint himself as a Roosevelt, as an FDR. But, you know, FDR actually reached out to the manufacturing sector and the businessmen of the day, his dollar year men. And, you know, one of the guys he reached out to was Henry Kaiser, who, amongst a lot of other things that Kaiser did, figured a way of floating 3 Liberty ships a day. I mean, we, in 1943, we were launching 3 Liberty ships per day. Now, let's look at today. We've got just over 100 ethanol plants. If we were to have 1,000 Liberty ethanol plants making 60 million gallons a year, that's 60 billion gallons of ethanol. Now, that does not displace the use of all of our imported petroleum, but it certainly displaces the amount we're bringing in from the Middle East. And so maybe it's not as big a step as Mr. Bloom's talking about, although I applaud his thoughts on that, but it's certainly very doable. An ethanol plant in every county not only provides the fuel made locally, it provides jobs locally. It keeps the money in that local county. And if we were to have 1,000 Liberty ethanol plants across the country, we could easily bring our boys and girls home from the Middle East. We wouldn't have to worry about that part of our energy equation.
You know, Larry, your comment about every county is a good one. And in my book, I lay out a very interesting scenario, which is based on current technology, nothing new, where if every county in the United States, and there's over 3,000 of them now, built a sewage treatment plant based on cattails, which are already used to treat sewage in many places in the United States. Cattails are 60% starch. So if every county in the United States built an alcohol plant next to its sewage treatment plant and treated its sewage using cattails, we would use less than 1.5% of the farmland of the United States to do that.
I love it. That is,
and we would replace 200 billion gallons of fuel a year. In other words, more than we currently produce.
David, so, you're too much fun. We're going to have to take a quick break. Do stay tuned. Right back. 800-624-2665. 831-479-1080. Well, what about it out there? Can we grow our food? Can we grow our fuel? And grow cheap and live high on the hog at the same time. We've been doing it for a long time, but we're running short on energy. We're running short on just about everything. So we're going to see if we can do it. We're going to ask Larry Larry first. Larry Mitchell, American Corn Growers Association. What do you think? Can we grow our food? Can we grow our fuel and do it all at the same time and live high on the hog?
We can do both fairly easily. The challenge is your other part is doing it cheaply. And I don't think that the prices that we've been used to, over the last decade were sustainable for anyone, for our farmers or our taxpayers or anyone. And I think what we're seeing is a shift towards actually paying the price of what things cost, as you referred to earlier.
And if things cost it, well, what do you think you see in the future? Can our farmers grow our way out of this? Can we do it?
We certainly can, and I think we're looking at, Ms. Bloom was exactly right. I've never met a corn farmer. I've met farmers who raise corn as well as soybeans and cotton and sorghum and all of the other crops. And we can certainly move towards other crops that are more energy efficient to make energy. When we make that crossover into cellulose, it can go into things like switchgrass and a whole portfolio of probably over 100 crops that work better than corn. That's what we'll do. Of course, corn's not the answer. It's the current answer, and it's only one component towards energy independence.
David Bloom?
Well, Larry's absolutely right. Farmers have always shifted to meet what was needed by this country, and they can do it again. And I think what we need to see is a closer collaboration between farmers and folks in the city. One of the things we're about to do in in the city, in Santa Cruz here, we're about to put in a driver-owned alcohol station come this October, and we expect following that to contract with local farmers on the small scale, and I'm talking not 60 million gallons per year, I'm talking about 2 million gallons per year, to produce the fuel for that station, for the 2,000 people that'll be using that station. And I think that's the model of the future, which is the model of my old farm, which is community-supported agriculture, where consumers directly contract with the farmers to provide them with what they need and cut out everybody in the middle. And
So how is Rockefeller going to feel about that? What is he going to think about that?
And
Rockefeller was the one who, objected to this in the first place, right?
The way Big Oil is going to feel about it is something that I'm not permitted to express on this radio station legally. I mean, the words I'd use would be kind of rough. But, I don't really care what the oil companies think. It's time that we, as citizens, take control of this thing ourselves. Because we can't count on the government to do it. We can't count on the corporations to do it. It's really up to each of us to go ahead and shape this next stage in our energy future, because it really, the future of the planet is at stake. We can't keep using fossil fuels. So that's why I wrote this book on alcohol can be a gas, so that people can go out on multiple scales, mostly on the farm scale, but also even smaller and larger, and produce their own fuel, produce their own great food byproducts, and at the same time basically drain the market away from the oil companies.
There you go, folks. Can we do it? Can we grow our food and can we grow our fuel and can we do it and still live high on the hog? I'll log on your comments at metrofarm.com forum and see you next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.